That's the first time I've had to use the gavel, but everybody was so excited to be here. So the Healthcare Regulation Subcommittee will come to order. Sabrina, please call the roll.
Chair Salzman.
Here.
Representatives Burfield.
Here.
Bartleman. Abbott.
Here.
Anderson.
Here.
Baker.
Here. Sorry.
Bell.
Here.
Black.
She said
here.
Baker.
Tana.
Here.
Cheney.
Here.
Franklin.
Present.
Humchowski.
Here.
Persons Mullica.
Here.
Rudman.
Here.
Skidmore.
Here.
Snyder.
Here.
Tant. Trabuzzi.
Here.
Quorum is present, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Sabrina. I want to remind everyone to please silence their cell phone. So today we will receive a briefing from my favorite secretary of ACA on the Florida Medicaid study of enrollees with sickle cell disease, and then we will hear three bills. I saw you looking over there. Yes, Tom. HB 201, emergency refills of insulin and insulin-related supplies or equipment by Representative Bell. HB 227, intravenous vitamin treatment by Representative Garcia. And PCS for HB 197, relating to healthcare practitioners and massage therapy by Representative Lopez. So we will begin today by a briefing by ACA and the Florida Medicaid study of enrollees with sickle cell disease by Tom Wallace, Deputy Secretary for Healthcare, Finance, and Data, and Austin Knoll, the Deputy Secretary for Medicaid Policy. Welcome, secretaries. You are recognized.
Thank you, Chair Salzman and members of the committee. Happy to be here today to give you a list of a briefing of the prevalence of in Florida and the impacts on the Medicaid program. So during
Secretary, is your mic on?
It is now. I think my papers hit it and knocked off for a second, but I'm good now. So during the 2022 legislative session, the agency was directed to conduct a study to review and provide a report around enrollees who are diagnosed with sickle cell disease in consultation with the Florida Medical School Quality Network. So this report was completed and submitted by February 1st of 2023, so it's already been out there. And we have it posted on our website, so everyone has access to that report. And it talks about the impact of sickle cell on Florida Medicaid population. So the agency the first contract the agency had with the Florida Medical School Quality Network was in July of 21. And that contract serves to provide healthcare services and clinical outcomes for all Medicaid managed care plans. So the Florida Medical School Quality Network represents 8 different medical schools in the state of Florida. They range from Florida International University to the University of Florida, Florida State, Nova Southeastern University, Central Florida, UM, and also South Florida. Additionally, during the 2023 legislative session, Senate Bill 1352 was passed, which also requires the agency, with the assistance of the Florida Medical School Quality Network, to review sickle cell disease medications, treatments, and services for Medicaid recipients and develop a report. That bill says we have to develop a report essentially every 2 years, and the first one's going to be submitted on November 1st of 24. So the Florida Medicaid study of enrollees with sickle cell disease report was published last February, as I mentioned, and it serves to provide a complete review of the agency's findings for persons with sickle cell disease on Medicaid. The report encompasses background fundamentals of sickle cell disease, consultations we consulted with Florida Medical School Quality Network, who then consulted with some experts in the field. It looks at ages, populations, and demographics of the patients, utilization patterns, expenditures for Medicaid recipients with sickle cell disease, high utilizers of healthcare services and clinical treatment programs. The report analyzed data from the Medicaid program for over a 4-year period, so looking at data from 2018 to 2021. And the report included a cohort of individuals who were continuously enrolled in Medicaid for at least a 12-month period and had at least 2 healthcare encounters associated with sickle cell disease during that time. So this approach had identified 9,206 Medicaid recipients for inclusion in the study, and those are unique individuals. So over that time, Each of them may not have been in there for each of the 4 years, but over that four-year period, these are unique folks who showed up. So now that we've covered just the basics of the report and what we have kind of included in that, I want to discuss a little bit about sickle cell disease in general. This is an inherited blood disorder that affects the hemoglobin and causes serious painful side effects. Hemoglobin is a protein that carries oxygen through the red blood cells throughout the body. And so looking at figure one here, you can see that when there is only one set of hemoglobin genes, it has a sickle cell variant sequence. So the person has that sickle cell trait, which is not the sickle cell disease. So an individual can have the trait and not the disease. So typically, people with sickle cell trait have no signs or symptoms of actual sickle cell disease. But if there are two people with the trait and they have children, as shown was shown here in figure one here, there is a 25% chance that their kids will be inherited both sets of the sickle cell hemoglobin genes and consequently have the sickle cell disease. So you see on here, we got one of those four kids will have the disease. So additionally, if one parent has sickle cell disease, but the other parent does not and does not have the trait, then their child will have the sickle cell disease trait only. Also, if one parent has the disease and the other parent has the trait, then there's a 50% chance that the kids will have the disease. So you can see, based on the different combinations here, there's a different percentage chance that their kids can have the disease. So in this slide here, I want to get a little more specifics about the symptoms of the average sickle cell patient. The most common symptom here of sickle cell disease is the blood vessel blockage. And this blood vessel blockage occurs when the blood vessels are obstructed by red blood cells that are stretched into the sickle cell shape, basically it's a sickle shape, from cross-linking of the hemoglobin proteins. So the downstream from the blockage, organs such as the spleen, the eyes, so the retina in the eyes, and bones, will essentially suffocate and then start to fail and die. And this is a very painful process where individuals go through this. So conditions like dehydration, viral infections, also stress, can be a leading item to provoke the blockage of these blood vessels and cause pain and suffocating of the organs. The life expectancy of someone just normally here is around 76 years of age. If an individual has sickle cell disease, that life expectancy would drop by about 20 years, so it's around 54 years of age. So the prevalence of sickle cell disease in Florida Medicaid has appeared stable over the past several years. Here in figure two, if you take a look at that, you can kind of see that stability, so it hasn't fluctuated too much here. But Florida Medicaid does have one of the highest numbers of sickle cell patients in the state of the United States, essentially. Florida and New York are the highest numbers of Medicaid recipients that have this disease. We're followed by Georgia's followed as us, along with California and Texas. So in Florida, we found that the yearly average of Medicaid recipients with sickle cell disease is 7,328. So that's a yearly average over this period that we've looked at. Roughly 70% of sickle cell patients in Florida, so if you just look at the total sickle cell patients in Florida, roughly 70% of those are going to be on the Medicaid program. So in Florida Medicaid, the median age of our patients with sickle cell is 18 years old. So that's the median. So we just looked at the lowest age and the highest age, and that median there is 18. Roughly 60% of Florida Medicaid recipients with sickle cell disease are female. So it's essentially a 60-40 split, which is consistent with the general population for Medicaid too. So that gender is slightly female prominent in the Medicaid program. Additionally, 63% of our recipients who provided their actual data to us with sickle cell disease are Black. And most of the population with sickle cell live in Central and South Florida, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a couple slides here. But I want to point out about the 63% that when you look at, if you look at the report, we do have a chart in that report. That's 63% that had actually presented in the data as being Black. There is 29% that are unidentified. So they didn't identify what their race is in the data. So, but the assumption is that majority of those would be Black too. So that real number is probably higher than 63%. So on this slide here, we are showing some detailed percentages that give insight to healthcare services that are administered and experienced of recipients that have the sickle cell disease. So first here, we're looking again over this four-year study from 2018 to 2021. And the care and treatment is received for both the inpatient and outpatient settings. So that's where these individuals go to get treated. 85% were evaluated and treated in an outpatient clinic type setting, and 52% were admitted to a inpatient hospital. The majority of the recipients that experience crisis events do have to go to the ER, and 61% of the recipients were evaluated and treated at an ER at least one time, and 39% didn't have to go to the ER at all. Also, we have children between the ages of 2 to 16, so looking at that specific cohort out of the total population that we have, there's 2,906 children there. 41% had at least one of these scans done to them, and this scan is done to look at potential risk for stroke, because with this disease, this is one of the issues that could happen to the recipient is stroke. And you see that 41% did have that test to see if they were at risk for it. Of the total population looked at, the 9206, 7105, so 7,105 individuals, or 77%, had a pharmacy expenditure for sickle cell disease. All right, so some medication to assist them here, while 23% had no pharmacy expenditures whatsoever. So common treatments among this cohort are oral penicillin and then hydroxyurea. So the penicillin is especially recommended for children under the age of 5 years old. The middle column on this chart here represents the number of eligible patients for the medication, and the third column represents the percent of patients that are actually taking a prescription. So you might be looking at this and saying, well, why are these numbers so low here, or these percentages? And according to our report, and we did lay this out in the report itself, that there are some reasons here and some barriers that are to these recipients for receiving certain medications to help them out here. And one includes physician and patient awareness, fear of side effects. Some of these patients have a fear of have a side effects on the medication, so they don't want to get it. There's doubts about the efficiency of the information and the data that's available as well. So in the four-year study period, their total pharmacy expenditures per year range from approximately $4,300 per person to $6,200 per person. That averages out to about $4,500 per year for the pharmacy expenditures. And in 2021, we spent a total of $91 million on prescriptions for this population. Medicaid recipients with sickle cell disease, as I said earlier, do live in pretty much every region of Florida, but it is heavily localized down in Central Florida and South Florida. And you can see that out here by the data. And this data is indicative of outpatient disease management. So a few key elements to keep in mind with the determination of the high utilization category, which we, again, describe as two or more ER or inpatient visits within a 12-month period. So there are much higher numbers of encounters with sickle cell patients that have pain crisis. When sickle cell patients have no pain, nearly all patients receive the care exclusively in an outpatient setting. That means a non-hospital setting. For people with pain crisis, the majority receive their care in a combination of either outpatient, ER, or hospital admissions. But nearly all people with pain crisis are cared for in the outpatient setting as well. So very few are seen in the actual emergency room or require hospitalization. Also, very few people are linked to skilled nursing facilities. We did examine those cases, and they are all adults, and they mostly reside in the North Florida region. High utilizers of acute care services matter in the context of Florida Medicaid objectives to reduce costly care, increase quality of care, and improve patient experience. So rebalancing care of sickle cell disease patients from acute care settings to ambulatory settings is a key strategy to improve the outcome of and the objectives. So now I've gone through kind of an opening of this. I'm going to turn it over to Austin here, who will speak more about the clinical treatments of sickle cell disease and the coverage of prescription drugs.
Thank you, Tom. Good afternoon, committee members. So when it comes to treatment for these programs, we need to recognize that Florida has a number of treatment programs or management programs throughout the state, specifically within our hospital systems, the Children's Hospital, as well as university teaching hospitals. As Tom laid out, you know, 77% of these individuals are utilizing pharmacy, 41% of children are screened for stroke, and as well as we have to manage pain management, organ damage, and others. And so by having these hospitals as part of our partnership contracted with our managed care organizations or our health plans, stated simply, is enabling us to help manage those that have this disease. But where are we going? There's some emerging treatments coming out for sickle cell disease, potentially as early as this week even or this month through the and that process, which I'll dive into a little bit more, has to do with the FDA, Federal Drug Administration, and then what are our steps from when that occurs to how does it land in Medicaid. So currently, there are two new gene therapies that these are one-time treatment options for those that actually have the disease. We'll talk a little bit more in detail about what that is. And once they approve, we need to understand how Medicaid will cover them. So the state is required to cover outpatient drugs under our prescribed drug services rule, which is under the agency's authority here, and it must be approved by the Food and Drug Administration as well as have a federal drug rebate. When we're talking about the FDA approval for new drugs, it's a multi-step process. First is the preclinical research. We need to understand what went into the development as well as the chemical functionality. In essence, how are the different interactions of the drug supposed to work? From there, we can have clinical studies conducted. They're documenting the impact as well as the drug on the human body. What is it doing? Not just is it achieving the desired outcomes, but also are there any adverse effects? From that point, the drug can be applied for as a new drug application, attesting to the utility or that the health outcomes are what we'd expect for them to be, given its form and its function. And last, once it's approved, there needs to be ongoing monitoring of the drug to ensure that there are no adverse effects once it's released to the greater population and any reactions that may have occurred outside of the normal clinical studies and approval process. Once there is the FDA approval, there then must be a federal rebate. And this is done through the Federal Medicaid Drug Rebate Program. This establishes a rebate that applies to all of the state Medicaid programs, not just Florida. And for branded drugs, that rebate needs to be at least 23.1%. And that 23% is off of the average manufacturer price. That average comes from across all lines of business, not just Medicaid, but you can think of commercial, Medicare, and other situations as well. But they look at the whole price from that manufacturer and average it, and that 23% comes from that. Once federally approved and we have the rebate, then the agency will develop coverage criteria based off of the clinical appropriateness, whether or not the drug is preferred, as well as the payment methodology. First, with the clinical appropriateness, we look at the indications of the drug. How is it intended to be used? What is it intended to be leveraged for treatment? An indication being primary or even secondary, where it's on-label versus off-label. We hear about drugs that are used for a variety of different things. We use that information based off what the drug manufacturer lays out as their prescribing information, as well as what the FDA has indicated it can be used for. Next, we look at the medical standards and the treatment algorithms, or plainly stated, how is the patient's prognosis advancing? What is their experience? Where are they? Not all drugs, even for the sickle cell disease, may not be appropriate for all patients based off where they are in their cycle. Next, when we understand, we want to look at cost and effectiveness and efficiency. We can also look at the number of Medicaid recipients impacted. How many individuals are we talking? And are there any alternatives available? So in the case of these potentially new program or these new treatments, we are looking at the potential costs and the per treatment, and Tom will be diving into how those costs will be factored in a few slides. From the clinical criteria, we then evaluate with the Medicaid Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee, for short P&T Committee, that meets on a quarterly basis. It's a joint process with us and outside stakeholders to look at the drugs that are on our preferred list. We're evaluating, the clinical criteria, what needs to be placed on whether they're preferred or not. But no matter what, there's still a pathway to access, whether it's preferred or non-preferred. It's just our preference over which drugs would go first based off the rebates and everything that we understand of those drugs. However, in order for a drug to be evaluated, by statute, it must be on the market and available. So it's not just approved by FDA, but actually systematically available for individuals to receive this treatment for at least 90 days. Now, from a timing perspective with the agency, if the FDA approves these treatments, our P&T committee is in the window where they would be able to review it and approve it potentially as early as March. So that's when we would expect the P&T committee to look at it again, if FDA approves. Additionally, when we're looking at the program, we need to consider supplemental rebates, or these are in addition to the federal rebate of 23%. Florida Medicaid requires that the rebate equal or exceed 29% to be on the preferred drug list. This just gives a little bit extra savings on top of what the feds already require. They're effective for 1 year if they're accepted and reevaluated every year. Another option that the state is looking at is entering into a value-based arrangement. We can get approval from CMS to enter into a value-based arrangement. Essentially, we are going to pay for a cost of a drug and ensure that we get the outcomes that we're looking for. This is supposed to be a one-time treatment option. It should cure sickle cell for those that it's prescribed to. But what happens if it doesn't? We want to make sure that we have appropriate arrangements and risk assurance and other things that we are utilizing, whether through additional discounts on the front end or value-based arrangements on the back end, to leverage to ensure that we are getting the health outcomes that we're looking for and the most effective and efficient price available. So this is utilizing the health system. Again, these individuals, the goal is to get them off of sickle cell, and then, you know, because of their probably debilitating condition with the pain and everything we're laying out, hopefully being back in the workforce, contributing back into society, working individuals where they're not debilitated by this condition, which is a great goal and phenomenal for the program. So with that, I'm going to kick it back to Tom to talk about the payment options.
So there are currently three different payment options that we're considering in order to pay for this drug here. We got a risk pool option, risk adjustment, or a kick payment. So the first one we'll talk about is the high-risk cost drug pool. All right, so with this option here, the agency could implement this pool, and it could be implemented throughout the year. This option would cover both the new and existing drugs that have high costs for treatment. So this option here will direct more funding to capitated plans. These are managed care plans that we have. So this is looking at the total cost of the drugs. There would be a monthly capitation payment to the plans that we currently make today. This would be paid outside of that. This is a risk pool. They'd be paid outside of that capitation payment. So the plans would still get their regular scheduled payments. And the overall funding of the pharmacy services in that capitation rate would be consistent with observed costs and other access to services. This risk pool, in terms of a con here, this risk pool would need to be fully funded. It does not mitigate capitation plan risks that are tied to uncertainties that happen throughout the year. And there are some additional administrative burdens here we listed out, but I don't look at that too much as a con here, because we currently today do have a prescribed drug high risk pool that we utilize for other high drug costs today. So this would just be, you know, something additional to take into consideration in that pool. All right, next is a risk adjustment. And this is our second option. With this option, monthly rates would include pharmacy drug costs and would depend on the payments that are made to plans relative to the risk scores developed by Milliman. Milliman is our actuary that sets our capitation rates. There is no additional administrative burden on this payment option here. Overall funding for pharmacy services in the actual rates that we pay today would be consistent with, again, observed costs and services. And payments would be directed to specific capitated plans that would incur new high pharmacy costs related to these risk-adjusted rate cells. Cons on this is that Milliman would have to develop an approach to exclude and make specific adjustments to account for this. And this would be looking at the actual relative weights and looking at the members, QD of the members. Additional payments would not be necessary directly to specific plans in this case. And then this does have some timing concerns trying to do it this way, not knowing if someone is using these drugs until the data is submitted, and the data can get submitted not immediately, so it could take some time for us to get that data. And then it does not mitigate the capitated plan risks that are tied to uncertainty surrounding the number of total utilizers that we have here in that rate year. And then lastly, the third option is what we call a kick payment option here. And there are both pros and cons to this option, just like the other two. The agency would implement a kick payment plan, and this would mean that each of our capitated managed care plans would utilize high-cost drugs, that utilize these high-cost drugs would get paid essentially once a month. So it's a separate payment outside of their normal capitated payment. This could be directed to specific plans that cover individuals for these new drugs. But some cons here would be that these kick payments cannot be paid until after all the claims have been reported. There is a complex administrative burden that's put on the agency to try to implement this. There is, if you're looking at the cost for utilizer, they could change significantly, and the kick payment can be either too high or too low, and there could be multiple kick payments for different types of drugs. So, it just becomes complex trying to implement something like this. And also, this may not be something that could be done in a budget-neutral manner. But all three of these options, again, we're trying to look at these and figure them out, what would be the best way to cover the cost of this sickle cell treatment. As you heard what Austin said, is we think we might get approval or hear from the FDA as soon as this week on the approval of this drug. And these are some options that we're looking at in terms of the payment and how to get the payments to our managed care plans. And with that, that is the presentation.
Thank you. Representative Botana, any acronym questions?
No, Chair, I didn't hear an acronym, so we're good to go. So.
Wonderful. Representative Bartleman, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I have two questions. When you went back to slide two, when you had the data that said 23% of the recipients didn't use pharmacy, did you look at those recipients and see if they had a high utilization of hospital and emergency room services because they weren't getting the drugs? Thank you.
You're recognized.
Thank you, and thank you for that question. 23%, when we looked at the data, did not have a pharmacy expenditure over that time frame, right? So like you said, there was no pharmacy, so they weren't using any of those medications. We have not, to my knowledge, gone back and correlated that back to the inpatient side. But as I said, if you look at the slide there, there's not a high amount of inpatient use on this. You know, a lot of these people do go and seek just the outpatient physician's office services, but I did not, I don't have that data in front of me if we've looked at that.
Follow up? Yes, and so I would hope that you would see if there's a correlation, because that would be important, because you would want to then make sure that if they have a high use of emergency rooms, that you get them the education they need, that they could be on the pharmaceuticals. But then this goes to the new drugs. In all the scenarios, how would you choose, if this is the new, I've seen people with sickle cell, I have a great clinic in my district. I've seen someone have an episode. It's very painful. How are you going to determine? I know you have a risk assessment, but how are you going to see who's going to get that in some of those scenarios? You're going to have to pick people who get this new, hopefully it's a miracle drug. How does that, I just don't understand how you're going to do that. I understand you'll say they have the risks. Can you go into that a little bit? Because that's scary. Because I'd want to be the one that was picked.
You're recognized.
Yep. Thank you, and thank you for that question. We're not going to be necessarily the people that are picking who's going to get this drug. If once it's approved by the FDA, it's going to be available for any Medicaid recipient that has sickle cell that's willing to come to the table and do it. We do understand that there are some hospitals in Florida that are getting ready to be able to perform this procedure, but this is a very intensive process that they'll have to go through with this. So it's really going to be up to the recipient if they're ready to go through this and do this. So I would say, you know, when we look at the cohort of people that are out there that could potentially get this, you know, get this treatment here, in this first year, it's probably going to be a slower uptake. I think people are just going to want to see what the results are like, what happens here. So I don't see that we won't have a whole bunch of folks that run out to get this done.
One more follow-up. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. But in your slides, you referenced that the managed care plans will have some decision-making and the rates and the reimbursement and all of that. So you're kind of leaving that up then to the managed care plans? So that's what I didn't I was trying to understand that. So if I misunderstood that, just explain that to me. And because they're going to make decisions based on reimbursements because they're not going to want to lose money. So
you're recognized.
Thank you, Representative. And to add on to what Tom was saying and to clarify, first, the clinical criteria and the conditions in which the drug is approved is going to be set by the FDA. And so they are going to help us understand and set that baseline clinical criteria, right? And then further with the P&T committee, our Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee, will establish any other, if there are any other additional criteria, conditions or things where we just don't leap all the way to the most expensive treatment possibly. However, when it comes down to the managed care plans, they are required to follow our preferred drug list. We have a single one for all of our health plans, and so all of them must follow what the agency sets forward. So once we approve it and put it on that list, all plans are required to follow that same criteria that we lay forward. So they won't have the choice of choosing whether to cover it or not, or establish any other supplemental criteria to limit it.
Thank you. Representative Franklin, you're recognized.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thanks so much for coming today and all the research you've done in reference to Medicaid and, of course, sickle cell disease patients. My question's around, you talked about the gene therapy. What are some of the predictions that you see from a cost perspective? I know you have a lot of gene therapy medications out there like Luxturna. That's, what, $850,000, now maybe $1 million. What are you kind of looking at from a cost perspective in the future?
You're recognized.
Yep, thank you, and thank you for that question. No, it's for these type of gene therapies is over $1 million, right? So it is expensive gene therapy to get done. But when you saw those payment options on there like that, for instance, the first option, a prescribed drug risk pool, essentially having a set aside dollar amount. So when a managed care plan performs this process here, there's money set aside to then come back and pay the plan for that. So we're well aware of the cost on that, and that's where we're trying to look at the payment options and how this is going to all play out.
You recognize for follow-up.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. My follow-up's around, you mentioned we spend maybe $91 million now in our drug spend. And of course, you know, this disease states cause other comorbidities, such as what, pain, stroke, organ damage, or failure. And so when we look at the total cost of what we're spending now to treat sickle cell patients, have done the modeling to kind of see what, I guess, number should we kind of target, if, even though they might charge us $1 million for it. You know, you mentioned, of course, the value-based agreement where we kind of track outcomes and ensure we meet those outcomes and get rebates along the way if we don't meet those. What's kind of like, have you done any modeling yet to kind of see what negotiations might be necessary for us to ensure that we can promise outcomes? Because, of course, I'm here and fully in favor of being able to cure folks from this debilitating disease, but also ensuring that we have outcomes that kind of match that, that makes sense for the state and taxpayers.
You're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. Tom and I are jointly working with our actuaries to model this out to understand what is a reasonable cost amount at, from if we go the capitated arrangement model, as Tom introduced, then that has a factor as to what do we need to pay the plans, right? If we need to add or modify our high-risk drug pool, what does that look like? So we're actively looking at that. One of the challenges right now is knowing what level of patient or conditions or criteria, comorbidities and other things are required in order to receive this treatment, right? Because as I understand it, it's more, you have to go through an autoimmune suppressant process. Well, that can be extremely difficult, especially if your organs are already damaged and failing. And so the FDA will lay all of that out for us, and that'll help us understand the total impact and help shape what is the best arrangement or option. If we go to the value-based arrangement method, then we'll also have an idea, okay, what is the quality-adjusted life years is an economics term that we look at from an economist's point of view, and what is the impact that individual will have by returning to the workforce, by producing all of those factors beyond just the medical costs, but the ripple effects that it would have on the economy are things that are being considered when we're having these discussions about the payment.
Yeah, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks so much for the answer. This is more of a statement. I know like Harvard's Pilgrim Insurance Program did something kind of similar with Luxturna. So there's a lot of examples out there back in like, what, 2017, 18, where plans had to kind of grapple with the concept of ensuring that there was much value in kind of helping patients get better and be permanently cured. They were dealing with like blindness, right, in the retina. But I'll be great to share it with you as well if you don't have that. Then, by the way, I have a good friend that works for you guys, Francisco Burgeon, so he's a rock star.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Representative. He is a rock star. For those that don't know him, he is our director of pharmacy and is one of the ones behind most of the information that we present today, so wouldn't be here without him.
Wonderful. Representative Anderson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, gentlemen, for the presentation, all the work that you've done on this. Also want to thank you for how accessible you and your team have made. You've been available to my office and me over the last few months, not only on this, but other topics. I genuinely appreciate that. I have two questions, Madam Chair, if you don't mind. The first one is, can you? I hear you talking a lot about, you know, this is a drug, and we know it's not, right? So this is a cell therapy or maybe gene therapy. I think it's a cell therapy, technically. But I'm assuming that's a category, right? So we're trying to fit this treatment into a category that we're calling a drug. But there's some rationale there, right? So can you shed a little bit of light on why that's the case? And is it as simple as that there's just no category for this type of therapy yet?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Representative, and it's a pleasure to work with you. And as far as categorization, in this situation, the federal government has taken it up as a drug and are exploring it as a drug. By them going down that path, we follow suit, especially if they go towards the federal Medicaid drug rebate program, that will, in essence, kind of force us to look at it as a drug as well. But you're right. These are emerging new technology treatments. There are a number that are on the horizon. Will they all be treated this way? I'm not sure right now. What I can say is one of the options that we're exploring is level setting us to have a template for value-based arrangements, not necessarily forcing us to have it just in drug or anything else, but allowing us to do it along the spectrum of treatment options.
Great.
You're recognized for follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the fact that you're looking at it as a template. You know, as you know, and we've talked about this a whole lot, that you know, this is the future of medicine. This is might be the first that we have to deal with ACA, but there's going to be more. So I definitely appreciate the fact that you're looking at it, that this, we have an opportunity to build it the right way from the beginning. And that leads me to the next question is, can you speak a little bit more about what you mean from these value-based arrangements? So, you know, I think it's critically important that we take care of our Medicaid population, but we need to do it in a way that also manages cost at the same time, and these are astronomical costs. And we need to make sure that we're getting what we're paying for, right? So we need to get the right outcome with the ultimate goal of curing people and getting them off Medicaid altogether. So can you shed a little light on what you're working on that value-based outcome area?
You are recognized.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative, for the question. I want to step back just for a moment. Value-based arrangement, many of you are business men and women and understand quality assurance, making sure you're producing the results that you expect, whether that's a production line or an audit, whatever it is in your realm that you do. So value-based arrangement simply is quality assurance. We want to make sure we are producing the outcomes that we're expecting. In the event we don't, we want to make sure that we are getting an appropriate refund for those goods and services. Similar in this space with gene therapies. They are new, they're emerging, right? Yes, there's 7,000 individuals in any given year from the study. That's a lot of individuals. However, when you think about overall population sizes, percentage-wise, it's still really small, but it's expensive. So we need to make sure these clinical studies and everything, they're actually producing the outcomes we expect. We've run they've run the test, the clinical studies, everyone says, yep, you're going to achieve it, great. But if not, we need an ability to recover and have that quality assurance at the end of the day.
Thank you. Next up is Representative Skidmore. You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. In terms of the population being predominantly young, female, and Black, is that, do you think, because of the eligibility of our Medicaid program, or do those numbers also track nationally with who typically has sickle cell disease?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you for that question. Yeah, these numbers are consistent, which you'll find in the other states that I mentioned, like New York and Florida and Georgia, very similar.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My second question, I may have heard incorrectly, so I apologize. I think you said at some point that there was an issue in the panhandle. Is there an access issue in the panhandle for people with sickle cell disease?
Oh, Secretary, you are recognized.
Yeah, thank you. thank you for that question. No, there's not an access issue. What I mentioned about the panhandle, there's just one small cohort, and I don't have the number of people here, but there are just adults that are in a skilled nursing facility. When you looked at the data here, and they've shown up in the Panhandle region. That was it. That was the only point I was making there.
Wonderful. We have Representative Abbott. You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I know you went through the three payment methods that we were looking at. I want to make sure, do we have a plan that these costs, because even after the 29% rebate, you're looking at a $710,000 per treatment base. That we're not allowing the plans to add the 3% admin fee into that and to use this in calculating their capitation rates for the following year.
You're recognized.
Sure, thank you, and thank you for that question. So as we're, this is new, right? We've talked about this, it's a new drug. We'll be working with our actuary Milliman in developing what the rate structure exactly look like. But we have those three options. Take, for example, that prescribed drug high-risk pool there. That sets aside some money each year that would be paid for high-cost drugs. And when we look at that pool today, we look at our rate year. So rates are based on a rate year, it's October through September each year. So we're currently in a rate year here. They'll go through September. When you look at that and you kind of get a feel for how many recipients we feel like might present themselves for services if this drug is approved this week or a couple of weeks from now, whenever it may be. We're looking at probably maybe at less than 20 people that will present themselves here. And when looking at that, we would have enough funding probably in that drug pool today to cover this now. Moving forward into next rate year, I don't know that yet. This is something that we work with our actuaries to develop what the rates will be, and they'll take into consideration emerging trends and everything else they're hearing about this drug and the usage of it moving forward, which would essentially be captured into that capitation rate that would be effective next October, and those costs would be built into that.
You're recognized for follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The follow-up would be this. I know we're going through the Medicaid patients and the Medicaid numbers. Do we kind of have a plan in place for, I mean, this is over $1 million therapy, for patients in the state that are on, that have sickle cell and are currently not on Medicaid? That becomes a factor into wanting to figure out, how do I get on Medicaid for this treatment? Have we looked into what that potentially could do?
You're recognized.
Thank you, and thank you for that question. Yeah, we're referring to the Medicaid population here, and these numbers are all Medicaid. There's probably other folks in Florida that have sickle cell, right? I said 70% of the total population with sickle cell would be on the Medicaid piece, so there's that other 30%. They would have other forms of insurance that would essentially cover this potentially based on their insurance care. I don't know that detail.
Thank you. Representative Redmond, you're up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you both for this presentation. I mean, wow, what a pretty complex topic. I mean, I feel like we almost need to take a break for 5 minutes just to digest everything. So I appreciate the effort you've put forward in this presentation. But I do have a couple questions. Now, I'm a physician, y'all probably know that, but if you could speak to me in layman's terms just for a second. When we talk about drug rebates, I'm looking at slide 15. So when we talk about the Medicaid drug rebate program, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm assuming you're describing a plan by which the drug companies go ahead and give us a discount of 23.1%. Am I understanding that properly?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Representative, for the question. Yes, that is correct. Where the manufacturers are required to participate in the Medicaid drug rebate program, and that comes from the average manufacturer price, which in the brand scenario, which this would be, is from that company based off, they have to disclose to the federal government all of their pricing across all their lines of business. And from that is an average, and the rebate is 23% from that.
You're recognized.
And my follow-up would be, it looks like on slide, I don't know, a couple slides later, we're talking about Florida supplemental rebates. It looks like to be considered for the Florida Medicaid plan, they have to give us a further rebate that equals or exceeds 29%. Am I reading that correctly?
You're recognized.
Thank you. What's intended there, Representative, is for it to be in total. So there's the 23% and an additional at least 6% on top of that.
Follow up.
Are there any brand name drugs that you know of that are commonly used for sickle cell where the manufacturer just says, we're not doing that, we're not participating in the Medicaid drug rebate program?
You're recognized.
I'll have to take that back, Representative. I am not personally aware of any, but I will confirm and get back with you just to be sure.
Follow up.
One final follow up. If we can go back to slide 9, where we're talking about the treatment of sickle cell disease. I guess where I'm going with my questioning is, when I look at that list, when we start with penicillin at the top and then you go down to hydroxyurea, followed by some others, as that percentage declines, I can tell you what increases as the percentage declines. What increases is the cost of the drug. I'm wondering if that's a coincidence.
Is that a question? You're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you for that question. I'm not sure if that's a coincidence.
Representative Vice Chair Burfield, my partner, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a quick question. We have talked about the cost impact. Is there consideration ever given as we evaluate the cost impact to the cost benefit meaning, so I, traditionally, I would not be a sickle cell patient, but let's say I am a sickle cell patient. I am Medicaid qualified. More than likely, I'm going to remain on Medicaid. That being the case, you'd see me as a lifetime patient. So if I'm going to be receiving a certain level of treatment through the rest of my life at the cost of the program, a Medicaid program, how does that factor out? Because as I understand, this new potential treatment would actually cure it to some degree. And if that's the case, we then have a benefit that we're actually picking up with the cost that we're experiencing. So I'm just curious how that is figured into how we deduce whether or not to incorporate that onto the formulary.
You're recognized.
Sure. Thank you, and thank you for that question. You're right. This is a cure. I mean, this will cure this. So everything that these individuals are going through today with the drugs that they're on and they go into the outpatient setting, or even if they have to go to the ER or inpatient, that should be eliminated here if this is a cure right in the future. So there is a benefit for that. But that certain dollar amount and that how much that's going to save in the future, we haven't really done and dug into an analysis because we really don't know how many people are going to show up right now and present themselves to really determine that. But we do, to your point, we do know that this is a treatment and this should then cure that.
Thank you. So I would just like to say thank you to everybody for all the, this is a lot. And I mean, it's such a small population of Florida, and we have so many of these cases of small populations with small incidences occurring, and oftentimes they get left and they don't get any help and they're struggling. And so all of the people before us that started carrying this torch and getting it across the finish line and then working so hard to find some relief for these people is amazing. And I'm really grateful for the presentation today and all of the very inquisitive questions. I think that we covered quite a bit, but everybody was really interested in what the outcome was and where we were headed. So thank you for your presentation today. My favorite secretary, Secretary Wallace,
welcome.
I appreciate you. Having said that, I have Florida's best rheumatologist in the room, Dr. Brian Kirby, right there. Y'all, that's right. Give him a hand. I love him. Secretary, if you wouldn't mind connecting with him, I would love for you two to talk about some stuff. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, so changing directions a little bit. We are going to hear HB227, intravenous vitamin treatment by Representative Garcia. Representative Garcia, you are recognized to present your bill.
Good afternoon, Chair Salzman, Vice Chair Bearfield, Ranking Member Bartleman, and members of the subcommittee. I would like to begin by thanking you for allowing me to present House Bill 227. Intravenous vitamin treatment, also known as the Stephanie Velez Act. Intravenous vitamin therapy is a relatively recent medical trend that involves administering a high-dose mixture of vitamins, minerals, electrolytes, and other fluids directly into a patient's bloodstream. This treatment is different from other applications of IV treatment in that it is frequently used among otherwise healthy individuals with goals ranging from achieving a general feeling of wellness to curing a hangover. However, the issue with the therapy is that it's not regulated by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Additionally, it doesn't require a physician referral and could be provided without first obtaining a patient's complete medical history or recent blood work. Another problem is that many of those partaking in treatment aren't aware of its effects or risks. The treatment could be especially dangerous for individuals with heart disease and kidney problems. The IV treatment can also cause allergic reaction from poorly interacting with other medications being taken by the patient. Without reviewing the patient's current blood work, for example, sudden changes in electrolyte balances could cause fatal heart cardiac arrhythmia and other complications that need immediate medical care. Stephanie Belize, whom the bill is named for, died from an IV treatment. Stephanie was 25 years old, a nursing student with no health issues or allergies. It took a year for the family to find out the cause of death. Finally, the coroner's office found the cause of death to be selenium poisoning from the IV administered to her. I filed this bill because I don't want another Stephanie Belize. With your favorable support, this bill would instruct the Board of Nursing, Board of Medicine, and Board of Osteopathic Medicine to adopt the following rules. First, it would require patients to complete a self-screening risk assessment questionnaire before receiving the treatment, and would prohibit healthcare providers from administering the treatments to patients for whom it would be unsafe. It would also mandate healthcare patients to provide and warn patients of the potential side effects and risk of intravenous treatment, and when they would need to seek medical attention. Once administered, healthcare providers would be instructed to notify a patient's designated physician and maintain a written plan for emergency care. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions on the bill? Seeing no questions, we have amendment barcode number 390703 by Representative Garcia. Please explain your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment is to exclude hospitals from this law because the hospitals are treating cancer patients and people that have been prescribed this by a physician. So it wouldn't do what it's expected to do. So I ask for your favorable support of the amendment.
Any questions on the amendment? Seeing no questions, is there public testimony on the amendment? Any debate on the amendment? Representative Garcia, would you like to close on the amendment?
I waive close, Madam Chair.
Show the amendment adopted without objection. And now we're on to the main bill as amended. And we have two public testimonies. We have the healthcare, or that's me, Clay Meenan, waves in support. He is with the Florida Hospital Association. And we have Ellen Anderson, who waves in support, and she's with the Moffitt Cancer Center. Members, is there any debate on the bill? Representative Rudman, you are recognized in debate.
Thank you, Representative Garcia, for this bill. And I agree with you. We don't need another one of these cases. And it's great that you're here today proposing this. Now, in principle, you're not going to find me agree very often with putting regulations in place in front of physicians. I don't normally agree with that. But we are talking about things that are unregulated. We're talking about things that are dangerous. So on this front, you have my support. You mentioned something earlier. You said these IV treatments, they're not regulated by the FDA. For those people that don't know, that's code for it probably doesn't work. You probably shouldn't be getting these things. So I would encourage anybody who's listening, if they go to any of these quote-unquote IV clinics, and we do have several in the panhandle as well, they tend to pop up where the people are more affluent. So again, you can connect the dots there. But if you are going to one of these places that's less than reputable, I would encourage you to do your research. The fact that it is not regulated by the FDA, that should be very telling. I appreciate you doing what we have to do to kind of shine a light on this, and you have my full support on this bill.
Thank you.
Members, any other debate? Seeing no further debate, Representative, you are recognized to close on your bill.
I waive close, Madam Chair.
Please call the roll on HB 227 and announce the vote.
Chair Salzman?
Yes.
Representatives Burfield?
Yes.
Bartleman?
Yes.
Abbott?
Yes.
Anderson?
Yes.
Baker?
Yes.
Bell?
Yes.
Black?
Yes.
Botana?
Yes.
Cheney?
Yes.
Franklin?
Yes.
Komchowski?
Yes.
Persons Mullica?
Yes.
Rudman?
Yes.
Skidmore?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Tant?
Yes.
Trabuzzi?
Yes.
18 yeas, 0 nays.
Awesome. Show that bill reported favorably as amended. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Next up, we have PCS for HB 197, Healthcare Practitioners and Massage Therapy by Representative Lopez. Representative, you are recognized to present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Vice Chair Burfield, as well as Ranking Member Bartleman and the members of this committee. This PCS bill for House Bill 197 is legislation that provides the Department of Health and local governments with the additional authority to shut down massage establishments which are determined to be a nuisance under state law and suspected of human trafficking. Florida ranks third in the United States for human trafficking, with Miami, Tampa, and Central Florida being the top three areas. Illicit massage establishments continue to thrive in Florida, offering commercial sexual activity under the guise of massage therapy services. Many are trafficked under force, fraud, or coercion. Current provisions of Chapter 480 Florida statutes related to massage therapy are insufficient to stop human trafficking, as illicit massage establishments can satisfy the Department of Health inspection checklist. The effects of PCS for House Bill 197 are: the legislation addresses stakeholders' concerns and ensures the closures of these illicit massage businesses. The bill clarifies the Department of Health's authority to issue an emergency order to suspend a license based on sexual misconduct and immediate danger to the public. It clarifies a quorum requires for the Board of Massage Therapy, and it allows for the closure under existing Department of Health provisions. And lastly, the bill also moves existing Department of Health rules as related to sexual misconduct and advertising into statute to ensure compliance. And that is the bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Members, do we have any questions on the bill? Representative Skidmore, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Rep. Lopez. When we talked previously, we talked about making sure that the target was not the individual person who is potentially trafficked. And in the bill, it requires DOH to report anyone working without government ID to immigration. I'm a little concerned about that. Why wouldn't we have DOH maybe look at the Attorney General's Task Force on Human Trafficking or advise those folks? Why are we going to victimize these folks for a second time?
You're recognized.
Thank you for the question, Representative Skidmore. So currently, the Department of Homeland Security actually deals with victims of human trafficking and gives them immigration relief. So for any victim of human trafficking, and this would be the person as you have described it, right, they actually get to apply for what is known as a T visa or a U visa, which allows them to continue to work as they cooperate with law enforcement under the prosecution of this particular trafficker. So this has been ongoing for many years, and it is the process for law enforcement to... What they all know is that if you find someone in a massage establishment who does not have any kind of ID of any kind that shows that they are a citizen here, that is a potential sign that there is probably a human trafficking ring that's international. And so that's where the Department of Homeland Security comes in and helps the women, men or women, whoever's being trafficked as a victim, to really stay in the country, to continue to work. They really do see them as victims, and they do allow for a particular visa, which then allows them after 4 years to apply for a resident visa.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If in the course of the investigation that's happening and you identify a person who has no ID, is law enforcement arresting that person, or is law enforcement taking down names and hopefully at some point later, if you let them go, that you are able to find them and give them the help that they need? Why not give them the help that they need right there, not through immigration, which is terrifying for someone, but through an easier access?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So thank you again for that further clarification question. So what ends up happening with the victim is that they're not arrested. They're notified. They are absolutely seen as victims. So they are not arrested. They are helped with the Department of Homeland Security, who then takes them under their wing and ensures, because many of the victims don't want to participate in these prosecutions. They're scared of the trafficker. And so what the Department of Homeland Security does is it says, no, we understand your position. We want very much to help you. So we're going to help you actually stay here. We're going to allow you to work under this legal visa. And in addition to that, we will allow you in 4 years, if you're still here and you're still working, to actually apply to be a resident alien of the country, because they see them, they don't see them as the person who's wrong. They see them as the victim. And so our Attorney General office does not have that jurisdiction. Only Homeland Security does, to protect them.
Any further questions, members? Seeing no further questions, we are on public testimony, and I have Eric Shutoff with AANR Incorporated waving in support. I have Ramon Mori with AANR waving in support. And then I have my junior league sister, Erin Collins, wishes to testify on behalf of the bill. Okay, just kidding, waving in support then. She's an opponent of the bill, or proponent, I apologize. And then next up is Laura Donaldson with the Collier County Sheriff's Office, waving in support. Would you like to speak? No? Okay, awesome. And now we are on to debate. Members, and any members in debate? Anyone else? I'm just kidding. You're recognized.
Representative Lopez, thanks for talking with me the other day about your bill. It's, as you recall from our conversation, it's hard to believe that we're still dealing with this. So thank you for taking this head on. You know, when I was appointed to this committee, you know, I'm thinking of things like, you know, addressing Medicaid, you know, the cost of drugs, you know, recruiting more physicians to Florida. It's hard to believe that we still have issues like this. And thank you for shining a light on this. You know, you have my support on this.
Representative Tant, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to say thank you for bringing this bill. Florida is the third worst state in the nation for human trafficking, and we recently had a sting here in Tallahassee that we had several hundred women who were being trafficked that we found. So I'm going to be a yes on this bill. I want to say thanks for bringing it.
Thank you.
Any other members wishing to debate? Representative Honchowski, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Lopez, I appreciate our discussions and I appreciate the intent of the bill. I will be up on it today, but I would like to continue our conversations about the immigration aspect of it. My biggest concern is that women who have been victimized, that they become re-victimized by the system. And I want to make sure we have guardrails in place so that we are going after the perpetrators, but not re-victimizing victims. So thank you.
Thank you.
Any other members wishing to debate? Seeing none, Representative Lopez, you are welcome to close on your bill.
I'll waive close, Madam Chair.
Having waived close, Sabrina, please call the roll for PCS HB 197 and announce the vote.
Chair Salzman?
Yes.
Representatives Burfield?
Yes.
Bartleman?
Yes.
Abbott?
Yes.
Anderson?
Yes.
Baker?
Yes.
Bell?
Yes.
Black?
Yes.
Botana?
Yes.
Cheney?
Yes.
Franklin?
Yes.
Humchowski?
Yes.
Persons Mullica?
Yes.
Rudman?
Yes.
Skidmore?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Tant?
Yes.
Trabuzzi?
Yes.
18 yeas, zero nays.
Thank you for your support.
Show the bill reported favorably. Last but not least, we have consideration of emergency refills of insulin and insulin-related supplies by Representative Bell. Representative, you are recognized to present your bill.
Good afternoon, Chair Salzman, Vice Chair Burfield, and Ranking Member, Vice Chair Burfield and Ranking Member Barnman. This bill is very passionate to me. This is an insulin emergency bill. As you know, I think everybody knows in here that my daughter is a type 1 diabetic. And so I've been trying to get this across the finish line for some time now. But this, in 2016, Florida added emergency refills of insulin in the state statute. 22 states have passed some form of emergency insulin refill legislation known as Kevin's Law, following the tragic death of Kevin Halstead in Ohio. Over the New Year's holiday, Kevin's prescription for insulin ran out in refills, and he was not able to have it refilled at the pharmacy. So he ended up dying that weekend. And so this bill makes three updates to Kevin's laws in the statute that we already have on the books already. The bill replaces vials with standard units of dispensing up to 30 days supply, as many patients don't use vials anymore. Instead, they use pumps with cartridges, refills, and refill pens. The bill adds insulin-related supplies and equipment, which could mean needles, syringes, cartridges, symptoms, pre-filled pen systems, and anything necessary to administer the insulin. The bill increases the number of times someone can receive a life-saving medication in an emergency situation without a prescription. And that is my bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Members, we do have an amendment, but before we get to the amendment, are there any questions of the sponsor? Questions relating to the bill? Seeing none, we have amendment number 692007 by Representative Skidmore. Representative Skidmore, you are welcome to explain your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. This is a good bill, and I know you've worked really hard on it. My concern, and the amendment I'll explain, changes the language to make sure that those three times that a patient goes to the pharmacy for a refill are not consecutive, and that we do take out the word vial, but we don't put in statute the 30-day supply and the standard unit of dispensing. And that is the amendment, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Before we get to questions, I would like to ask the sponsor, is this a friendly amendment, Representative?
Absolutely, very friendly and glad to work with our party across the aisle and appreciate it.
Awesome, any other questions of the members? Seeing no questions, any public testimony on the amendment? Any debate on the amendment? Seeing none, Representative Skidmore, would you like to close on your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate working with you and the Diabetes Association and the coalition partners on this, and looking forward to making sure we get across the finish line. Thank you very much.
Wonderful. Seeing the amendment has no objection, show the amendment adopted without objection. And now we're back on the bill as amended. Do we have public testimony on the bill as amended? We do. We have Ron Watson with the Florida Renal Association waving in support. Donnie McMillan with Florida PTA waves in support. We have Etta Fernandez with AARP waving in support. Amanda Frazier with the American Diabetes Association waving in support. Members, do we have any debate? Anybody other than Representative Redmond? Representative Redmond, you are recognized.
Representative Bell, I just wanted to thank you once again for taking time out of your busy schedule this morning. I know we were kind of rushed. You know, I had a bill presentation of myself. You had meetings, but you found time to squeeze me in and address a couple of my concerns. And I really appreciate that. It's so good to work together to make a bill better. I had two main concerns about the proposed legislation. Number one is the rule of unintended consequences. You know, we didn't want a situation, I believe this is where the amendment came in handy. We didn't want a situation where we had someone who was maybe non-compliant with their physician, and through a law change, we effectively gave this person 90 days to effectively be their own doctor. So I really do appreciate you working with Representative Skidmore to get that ironed out. And then, of course, the other question that always comes up in situations like this, are we doing anything that involves scope of practice? Are we turning pharmacists into doctors? And, you know, I can assure anyone who's listening, and after talking to you, you know, I 100% know it, this is not scope of practice. All we're doing, we're cleaning up old language that's really no longer valid, and we're letting the pharmacists do what they need to do. For those people watching at home back in the Florida Panhandle, let me reassure some people, most physicians, or at least most physicians by us in the Panhandle, you know, in the real Florida, we get our refill requests 30 days in advance. So it would be very rare for a patient in the Panhandle to be cut off of their insulin. It doesn't say it doesn't happen, just say that there are rules in place that try to prevent that. Also, there's the fact that in the Panhandle, pharmacists such as my good friend Representative Abbott, they tend to work with us, right? So if my pharmacist knows I'm out of town, they will give that patient a couple days worth of any medicine, not just insulin. So again, I just wanted to reassure Floridians that this isn't a widespread tragedy. This isn't happening all across the state, but for when it does, I really do appreciate your efforts to make that number go all the way down to zero. Thank you so much. I'll be up on your bill.
Thank you, Representative, for that incredibly amazing commentary. Representative Abbott, you are recognized for debate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for this bill, a fantastic bill. I'm extremely up, and it's very helpful for public safety. And I don't think folks recognize that a lot of times. And it unties a pharmacist's hands Friday after 12 o'clock and on Saturday. And so thank you for this. This is a huge public safety issue, and I really appreciate you for bringing this bill.
Representative Bell, would you like to close on your bill?
Yes, I would. I'd like to have a couple of comments. Thank you, Rep. Abbott, and thank you, Dr. Rudman. I appreciate your comments. Last summer, I said I have a daughter. She's 39 years old, type 1 diabetic, so she's lived with it just about all of her life. We were at the beach Sunday afternoon. Something caught on her dress, on her pump, and guess what happened? All the insulin leaked out. She had no insulin. What are we to do? We're on vacation at the beach. She tries to call her doctor, which is in Mayo, could not get her doctors. Within 2 hours, she would have been probably going into a coma, a diabetic coma, if she had not got the insulin. I ended up calling my physician, which she had seen years earlier, and he said, of course, I'll write a prescription. But if she had not got that prescription, I would have had to take her to the emergency room, and we would have had to wait until she could have gotten the insulin. So this is going to keep people out of the emergency rooms. It's going to save us on the back end. But the most important thing is going to save lives. And with that, I close.
Thank you, Representative. Would you please call the roll on HB 201 and announce a vote?
Chair Salzman?
Yes.
Representatives Burfield?
Yes.
Bartleman?
Yes.
Abbott?
Yes.
Anderson?
Yes.
Baker?
Yes.
Bell?
Yes.
Black?
Yes.
Botana?
Yes.
Cheney?
Yes.
Franklin?
Yes.
Komchowski?
Yes.
Persons Mullica?
Yes.
Rudman?
Yes.
Skidmore?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Tant?
Enthusiastically, yes.
Trabuzzi?
Yes.
18 yeas and zero nays.
Fantastic. Show the bill reported favorably as amended. Members, that concludes today's committee. And with that, Representative Black moves we close. Adjourn.